our history. They could have left at any time, returned to Sharakai, hidden away in a caravanserai, fled the desert entirely. But they came here with me because they've seen the truth and they're ready to help. Hamid was beside himself with rage. I don't care what happened. He drew his sword with one violent motion. I don't care what they've made you believe. You were with them too long to see the truth. But as sure as the desert is vast, as sure as the kings are cruel, those two, he waved the tip of his sword at Sumer and Melisse, are ruddy fucking spies. I tell you they are not. Hamid spat on the sand. I'll not suffer their presence here. You will, Chayda replied easily. Chayda watched his every move, every flick of his sleepy, cold-blooded eyes. She saw his intent in the muscles of his jaw as they tightened, in his eyes as they narrowed, and she was on the move even before he had taken his first step. She drew River's daughter as Hamid burst into motion. She felt for his heartbeat and pressed against him as he turned and swung for her. She blocked one swing, spinning as she did so, and sent a heel to the side of his head. He was knocked off balance but didn't fall, so she stepped inside his guard and sent a gloved fist crashing into his mouth. This time he fell to the sand, dazed. Chayda dropped to his side, used a knee to pin his sword arm to the sand, and laid River's daughter across his neck. She leaned in until they were face to face. They are under my protection. I vouch for them both. If they betray us, I offer up my own life. Is that good enough for you? Blood and spittle flew from Hamid's mouth. It fell on his chin, mixing in with the whiskers of his light brown beard. She'd never seen him so mad. I'm going to kill them both, Chayda. I promise you this. And then, I'm going to kill you. By Thash's bright blade, she considered running River's daughter across his throat. He'd always been a rabid dog, so why not let his lifeblood seep into the sands? There was too much at stake to let a killer like Hamid decide her fate, the tribe's fate, and perhaps the fate of the Asirim as well. It was in that moment, as Thash's righteous anger burned ever brighter, that she felt Kerim clearly for the first time. He was hidden somewhere among the ships, feeding off her emotions. It was an echo of the compulsions of the gods, a thing that had somehow been largely removed from Karim's thoughts. Until now, that is. Her fear over what Hamid might do, and her own sudden bloodlust, had rekindled it. Like water thrown over a fire, the realization did much to douse her emotions. Karim's were extinguished a moment later, and they both felt shame for wishing the death of another, one of their own blood. Kerim's presence faded as Chayda pulled her sword away from Hamid's neck.
Enough! Came Ishak's voice.
With a shove, Chayda released him and stood up. Hamid did as well. He gripped his sword for a long time, staring at Chayda with dull, emotionless eyes. Her younger self might have been chilled by those eyes, but she'd seen enough Hamids in her life to know that sometimes you could only meet a threat with a threat.
Hamid,
Ishak began, but Hamid merely sheathed his sword and stalked away, bumping several people out of his way, until he was lost behind them. The expression on the face of the big one, Frail Lamai, had hardened throughout the conversation. He was now staring at Melisse and Sumeya, as if daring them to draw their blades. Then he too turned and followed Hamid from the gathering.
Until I say otherwise, Ishak began again, no one will touch the maidens.
The tension running through the gathered crowd waned perceptibly.
Go, Ishak said. We all have much to do.
At this, the edges of the crowd began to dissolve. No one, Ishak and Masid included, greeted Chayda, Zayid, or even Dadzada with open arms.
Chayda, Ishak continued, The three of you will tell me your story, and your words will be weighed against what Zaid and Dad Zada have to say, and what we already know of events in Sharakai. Only then will their fate be decided.
Chayda spoke before Dad Zada or anyone else could interject.
Best if I explain what I know first, then.
Ishak considered her request, then nodded curtly. They retired to Ishak's tent. Ishak, Masid, Leora, Dad Zada, and several more, Chayda had never met, sat around a cook fire with carpets covering the sand and pillows beneath them. Over the course of the next several hours, Chayda told her tale. It was a lot to take in, but she couldn't leave this tent. She wouldn't. Without reaching an understanding on Sumeya and Melis.
My tale begins and ends with the Asiram, Chayda said upon reaching the end. It is through them that more will come to believe, as Sumeya and Melis have. That's why I brought Sumeya and Melis here. That's why I've asked them to help me to free more of the Asiram.
Ishak idly scratched the only spot on his grey beard that had any color left in it.
The Asiram are important, but the kings will be wary of your return. They'll know about your Asir and be worried you'll try to steal more. You may have unknowingly helped us. The kings may have become wary of bringing the Asiram into the desert for fear of what you might do in response. It may even make them hesitant to come in full force, lest we return to Sharakai to do exactly what you've proposed.
All the more reason to strike quickly, Chayda countered. The kings cannot cover the whole of the blooming fields. We should go now before they can stop us.
Perhaps, but we must always think ahead, Chayda. If the kings are preparing to stop us at the blooming fields, we might give hint that we're ready to do just that, and then strike at another target. We might do that again, and only when they feel that the Asiram are a ruse do we go to free them.
The Asiram have waited for 4 centuries.
Ishak waved to a young boy who was tending to the Arak. As the boy moved to refill several glasses, Ishak regarded Chayda.
Their suffering pains me, but rash action will not aid them. Wait a few more months and we'll be more prepared.
Months become years in the blink of an eye.
For the first time, anger showed on Ishak's hoary face.
Then it will be years.
He flung one finger toward the door of the tent.
There is a king in the desert who may be sailing for us even now. There are maidens on your trail. The king's entire navy may be sailing behind them, hoping to catch us unaware. I will not risk the safety of our fledgling tribe because the plight of the Asiram has pushed you beyond reason.
I'm not asking you to. I will take Sumer and Melis, some few others, and return to Sharakai when the time is right. There we will free Sahith Alaz, for he, I believe, is the key. With his help we can break the bonds of the others.
You wish to return to Sharakai? Masid replied. With war on our doorstep?
No! I won't leave until Onur's fate has been decided.
You will leave when I tell you to leave, Ishak said.
Chayda stood to stare down at him. At them all.
I am not yet part of your tribe. I made vows to Sahid Alaz, to Karim, to his wife Hava, and to others. I promised to free them. I came here so you will have the benefit of everything I've learned, but I decide my own fate, not you.
The mood in the tent had changed from one of amused sufferance to outright hostility. A hum began to build, but quelled as Ishak raised his hand for silence.
Do you think to start your own tribe, then?
He asked.
Melis was a blade maiden who believed in the kings. Sumer was first warden. They risked everything to save me and to learn the truth, and when they learned it, they embraced it, even though it was painful,
even though it flew in the face of all they'd ever been told. Are they not the sort of allies we've been hoping for centuries? Are they not the sort of women who could spark a revolution?
You don't know their hearts.
I know their hearts better than I know yours. I've been to battle with them. I've bled for them and they've bled for me. I saw how viciously they both fought for what they believed in, and now they believe in us. They see our story. They see us.
Ishak was red-faced, but Chayda refused to stop.
I know you have the weight of our people on your shoulders, she said in a softer tone. I recognize that burden. I know its weight. But I beg you, let us seize the opportunity that Nalame herself has surely placed before us.
Masid, sitting by Ishak's side, raised his hand before Ishak could speak.
Chayda has said her piece. Perhaps it's time to listen to the maidens.
Ishak stared at Masid as if he had betrayed him. He looked as if he was about to say as much, but when Leora began to stir from her seat, he held his tongue. Leora held out one weighty arm and waved Chayda closer.
Help an old woman up.
In that moment, Leora's amethyst ring seemed to glow. Chayda blinked and it was gone, leaving her to wonder if she had imagined it. It might have been from the nearby fire, or the brilliant light of the setting sun as it played against the tent's western wall, but she could have sworn it had shone from within.
Come, girl, Leora waved her hand again. Don't condemn me to lie here all night.
Sorry, Grandmother.
Chayda helped her to her feet, then handed her her cane.
You're leaving? Ishak asked.
There are things Chayda and I must discuss, Leora said as she hobbled with Chayda's help toward the tent flaps. Listen to the maiden stories. Tell us your decision in the morning.
And just like that, they went out into the gathering dusk. Chayda glanced back and saw confusion in Ishak's eyes, even anger. But there was curiosity as well, an eagerness to know what Leora was going to say. Still feeling strange about leaving, Chayda walked Leora toward her yacht while Sumeya was summoned to the tent.
Don't you think we should listen to what they have to say? Chayda asked.
Chethamin, I love you, but you need to learn when to still that sharp tongue of yours. You challenged Ishak in front of everyone. Do you really think he'd listen to anything Sumeya had to say with you there? Leave them be. We have other things to discuss.
Chayda's first instinct was to argue, but it would simply be proving Leora's point. As they walked through the warm evening air, her head began to cool and a mystery began to tug at Chayda's thoughts. In the short walk from the tent, Leora's posture had straightened. She leaned on her cane less, her steps becoming steadier, even her breathing seemed more at ease. As they neared the gangplank to her yacht, Chayda asked,
Grandmother, what does your ring do?
Pretending she hadn't heard, Leora called out for Salsana.
Grandmother?
Leora made a face.
Never you mind, child.
And she motioned to Salsana, who had climbed onto the deck as if she had been expecting them.
There's something Salsana wishes to share with you.
Chayda decided to set the mystery of the ring aside for now. They had enough to worry about. The scars over Salsana's face and neck, evidence of her battle against Kerim, stood out in the sun's copper light. When Salsana joined them on the sand, Leora gripped Chayda's wrist, and the three of them headed beyond the line of ships. Soon it was clear they were headed toward a standing stone. In the long finger of its shadow was a figure hunkered low to the ground, nearly lost to the darkness. By the gods, it was Kerim. She hadn't felt his presence in the least. It was as if he had been masking himself from her.
Even now she could barely feel him.
"Why do you hide from me?"
she asked him. A long pause. Somewhere in the desert, a jackal yipped. Kerim's refusal to speak felt like rejection, though she was sure there must be another explanation. After all they'd been through, Kerim wouldn't do that to her, would he? But when she gave it a moment's thought, the reason Salsana led her here became obvious.
"You've bonded deeply with him," Shada said.
"Yes," she replied. "I've come to experience his dreams as you have. I felt his pain firsthand."
It proved that another could successfully bond with the Asirum, which was glorious news and made Chayda hopeful that Salsana had had luck on other fronts. She motioned to Salsana's wrist, where Masut's golden bracelet rested.
"Have you been able to reach them?"
Salsana stared with a defeated look into the large oval jet, which in the dim light looked like a deep, malevolent pool.
"I've tried many times. Like you, I felt the souls within, but I cannot speak with them. Not once have I felt more than their lament, their desire for release."
"How Masut released them into a living soul, I have no idea." Chayda hid her disappointment. Salsana had done well with Kerim, and the mystery of the bracelet was one that might never be solved. Her thoughts were interrupted as a ship's bell began to ring. Over and over it sounded, with several of the crew pointing and shouting,
"Ship ho! Ship ho!"
A cutter was sailing toward them. Her hull was a dark smudge of coal, her billowing ivory sails aflame in the dying light of day. On the deck, a pinpoint light began to blink in a clear sequence. Two flashes, a pause, then two more, over and over. A crewman was using a hooded lantern to send a signal to the distant ship.
"What does it mean?"
Chayda said. Salsana's eyes had gone wide.
"It's a warning."
She turned and began leading Leora back toward the yacht.
"The enemy approaches."
Since it was sailing in from the east, it surely bore news of Honor. An alarm bell rang, using the same sequence as the lantern light. In minutes, with fear driving every movement, the tents were torn down and stowed on the ships. The crews of every ship made ready, dozens working to tow the ships, so they faced south, a favorable position to catch the wind. When the cutter arrived, its captain rushed to speak with Ishak and the tribe's elders. Chayda was called to a circle a short while later. Ishak pointed east.
"Honor has betrayed and attacked tribe Kadri. He's now pursuing Emre, Shalalara, and what remains of tribe Kadri's fleet. They're leading Honor's ships away, but ask that we come in behind them and catch Honor unaware."
He turned to Sumeya and Melis.
"I've not yet decided what's to be done with you, but if all you've said is true, you can help your cause and fight by our side."
Sumeya considered and then jutted her chin toward Chayda.
"I will fight by your granddaughter's side."
Ishak looked ill-pleased.
"And you?"
he said to Melis.
"My sword is Chayda's to command."
Hamid snorted, his eyes burning with hatred for the Blade Maidens, but Ishak nodded.
"Good enough."
He looked to everyone and spread his arms wide.
"We go to battle a king of Sharakai. This isn't something I wished for so soon after coming to the desert, but the fates give what they will. It is ours to face it or flee."
Ishak drew his sword with a fluidity that surprised Chayda and faced the gathered crowd.
"Would you flee, tribe Kianat?"
"We will not,"
they answered. So sudden and powerful was the reply, it resounded through Chayda, made her yearn to release the anger that had been hidden inside her for so long.
"Our tribe's name was taken from the old tongue," Ishak went on. "In the days of our foremothers and forefathers, It had twin meanings. One is the forgotten.
He cast his gaze over the crowd. Chaedah had stood before the kings of Sharakai. She had stood before gods, and yet when Ishak's eyes passed over her, she felt a chill run along her limbs until her fingers and toes tingled from it. She had known Ishak drew people to him through the sheer force of his presence. She had seen some of it in Masid, but she had had no idea how strong it was. Not until now.
"Shall our name be spoken alongside Tribe Kadri, Salmuk, Ebros, Halarajan? Or will you suffer the desert to forget our name once more?"
"Never!"
Their voices roared in unison.
"Never again!"
Ishak seemed pleased.
"The second meaning is the betrayed. We took this name after Bet Iman for those slain in the centuries that followed, and for the children orphaned. There is no shame in admitting we were forced to hide amongst our brothers and sisters in the farther corners of the desert, for fear that we'd be murdered for acknowledging our blood. But times change. The sands shift. Now we have stepped free from the shadows."
A great shout lifted up, more emotion than words, and this time Chaedah joined them.
"Would you repay the betrayal of Bet Iman?"
"We would!"
"Will you repay that betrayal with your blood?"
"We will!"
"And with theirs?"
Swords lifted toward the night sky. The butts of spears were driven against the sand, and the cries built into a tumult of long-suppressed anger.
"We will!"
Ishak waved his shamshir high above his head.
"Then come, brothers and sisters! The desert is hungry, and Onur has escaped it for too long. It is time we give him back!"
As he made for his ship, the loudest roar of all engulfed him. Leora sat on the deck of her yacht while, all around, the ships were made ready to sail. Sarsana had gone to the desert to speak with Kerim, to prepare him for the morrow, which, if all went as Leora suspected, would see him reunited with a king for the first time since he had been dominated by Onord. She'd sent her own crew away.
"We're prepared enough," she told them. "Go, help wherever you can."
Leora was nervous. This was an event they had been hurtling toward for generations, and now it had arrived. She didn't know if they would survive, but what were they to do? They could not live in the cracks of the desert like mites until the end days. So while her fear was strong, so was her pride. So was her hope. Ahead, a woman approached her yacht, lit by the lanterns set fore and aft.
"Sarsana?"
The woman didn't answer. She kept walking, a staff in her hand. Three men passed only a few paces ahead of her, but remarkably none of them turned their heads. None seemed to notice the woman at all, even though she towered over them. Finally, Leora recognized her. Nalame. She had hair of honey, plaited so that it ran over one shoulder and down the front of her wheat-colored dress. She walked deliberately, ignoring all that was going on around her. When she came near enough for the lanterns to light her face, Leora gasped. She said nothing, however. She waited for the goddess to stop near the gangplank. With her gnarled staff, she thumped the sand until she heard the dull thud of wood. Then she walked up the deck and approached Leora's chair.
"I will admit," Leora said, "I never thought to see you again, not in this life." "I will never leave these shores,"
Nalame replied.
"No."
Leora felt the weight of the moment press down on her.
I suppose you won't. Have you come to help us, then?
Yes.
The goddess stared intently at the horizon, as if she could see beyond it.
You'll join us?
No, she said. But the time grows near.
There was little regret in her voice or on her broad face. She seemed exhausted, as if she had been traveling for weeks.
The morning brings great events. The fate of the desert prepares to shift one way or another.
It does,
Leora replied, more excited than she had felt in a long while. By the gods who breathe, she felt young again.
Tell me why you've come, Nalame.
Nalame held her staff before her like a spear ready to be driven into the ground.
I'm here to present you with a gift.
With shaking hands, Leora accepted it. She stared at it reverently, confused.
For what purpose?
Nalame smiled grimly.
To even the scales, granddaughter.
Chapter 55.
Chaedah stood on the foredeck of Ishak's own ship, the Amaranth, which sailed the morning sands near the center of Tribe Kianat's fleet. They had set after the black spear ships of Onor's fleet and continued all through the night. The wind had been strong in the starlit hours, but now it was nearly a gale, driving their ships over the sand with a speed that bordered on recklessness. They couldn't let up, though. The black spear ships were still a league ahead of Kianat's as they in turn shadowed Tribe Kadri's fleet. Chaedah could see them a half league ahead of Onur's ships, their sails bright along the horizon. In a few short hours, the three fleets were going to converge, hopefully giving Kadri and Kianat the advantage over Onur as they swept in from two sides. Now that they were close, the Kianat and Kadri fleets had begun coordinating their movements. The flagmen in the vultures' nests sent messages ahead and relayed answers to Ishak.
It won't be long now, Chaedah thought.
Soon dozens of ships would be locked in battle. She was as nervous as she'd ever been in the fighting pits of Sharakai before a bout, but her heart was singing. They had a chance to show not only the kings, but the entire desert, that the 13th tribe would no longer be silent. Using a spyglass, Chaedah tried to spot Emre, but the Kadri ships were too far away. She swung the spyglass left instead and studied the black spear ships, hoping to find Onur. She examined ship after ship and took note of the sheer number of warriors Onur had managed to gather to his cause. She saw the dozens of crews as they manned the ships and prepared for battle. Of the King of Sloth, however, she saw no sign.
Come,
Chaedah said to Sumeya and Melisse, who stood beside Chaedah along the gunwales.
We're nearing ballista range.
As the three of them headed amidships, the crew of the Amaranth sent wary glances their way. They were the pariahs of the tribe. Each wore her black maiden's dress, her black turban with veil hanging loose, and her ebon blade at her side. All three were symbols of hatred among all the desert tribes, but especially among the Moonless Host, whose warriors made up most of the tribe's number. Their presence was suffered, but only on Ishak's orders, and no one loved him for it. Every man, woman, and child on the ship looked as though they'd like nothing more than to throw the three of them over the gunwales, everyone but Maseed, who watched them approach while leaning against the main mast. Zaid and Salsana stood nearby, speaking softly. Leora was there as well, seated on a chair, hardly able to keep her eyes open. In place of her cane, she had a staff. It rolled softly beneath the chair as the deck pitched this way or that. Had her cane been lost? Karim lay at the base of the stairs leading to the quarterdeck. The blackened features of his frame were curled in misery. He had still not opened himself to Chaedah, but Chayda didn't blame him. Onur was close enough now that Kerim was surely already struggling against the magic that bound him to do no harm against the kings. The coming battle loomed, and she had no doubt he could enter the fray. Such was his rage. But could he finish it? She prayed that he could, and that Salsana could help him. They would need his strength in the coming battle. Zaid and Salsana stopped speaking as Chayda, Sumer, and Melis gathered round. Mesid watched and listened, his arms folded across his chest, revealing the snake tattoos that ran along his forearms. Sumer reached into the bag at her belt and took out a small clutch of dried Adhikara petals. Each was pure white save for one end, which turned a dusty blue, rather like clouds giving way to a clear sky. She began by handing one to Melis, Chayda, and Zaid. Then, in a show of solidarity, she held another out to Salsana. Salsana, however, refused her.
My bond with Kerim is strong enough. I would not jeopardize the balance we've found.
Sumer paused, perhaps wondering if it was worth convincing her otherwise. To Chayda's great surprise, she turned and offered the petal to Mesid instead.
The day will be long, she said.
It might help.
Mesid stared at it, then took in Sumer anew. In the end, he waved the offer away.
I'd likely chop off my own hand.
Sumer shrugged and placed the petal beneath her tongue. Chayda did the same, as did Melis and Zaid. As a war horn sounded in the distance, Chayda's awareness expanded. So often she'd felt as though the petals were a tool, little different from River's daughter. Things were different now. She knew so much more about the nature of the petals and the Adhikara. The twisted trees were fed by the blood of the innocent. The tributes taken from Sharakai and the power of the petals came from them. The tributes had been taken against their will, but through these petals they lived on, making the petals and the verve they granted feel like a gift, a thing to be cherished, a thing to be respected as well. So as the world around her became sharper, as the sounds of the skis against the sand intensified, as the baked smell of the desert filled her senses, she gave thanks to those who had died that she might be ready for the coming day. As the verve began to settle, she felt Kerim's discomfort more keenly. She also felt the strength Salsana lent him. Their bond was strong indeed. Chayda wondered whether she had shared as much with him. Perhaps not. She cared deeply for Kerim, but he'd never forgiven her for Hava. The Aesir King Cahil had murdered in King's Harbor, once Kerim's wife. Hava had imprinted herself on Chayda, much as Kerim had later done before the two of them had headed into the desert together. But Misut had sensed their shared bond and had killed Hava for it. There was no such history between Salsana and Kerim, and Chayda saw how truly powerful a bond could become. Again, Chayda wondered about Misut's heavy golden bracelet, wrapped around Salsana's wrist, the jet stone glinting dully in the morning light. Chayda wondered if they might find a way to unlock its secrets together, but it would have to wait until the battle was done. The war horns sounded again, three sharp blasts, an indicator that battle was imminent. Chayda was just turning to look for Anor on the decks of the enemy ships when a black line streaked through the air toward the Amaranth.
Cat's claws!
A crewman called. The line writhed like a snake. Two heavy balls of iron were affixed to the ends. It splashed against the sand, well short of their ships. A second came in, and a third. These aimed with more skill. One flew high and struck the ship to the Amaranth's port side. It thudded hard against the hull and fell to the sand. The other caught the ship behind the Amaranth. The chain wrapped around the starboard strut and slipped down to where the large iron hooks affixed to the weights dug into the sand. It not only slowed the ship, it forced it sharply starboard. Cat's claws weren't meant to debilitate, but to sow chaos, to prevent an enemy's force from striking all at once. More of them flew from both lines. Two launched from the Amaranth's catapults, arched swiftly toward a black spear galleon. One caught ineffectually in the ship's shrouds. The other snapped around the galleon's rudder. The chain seemed fouled for a moment, the hooks too high, but then it dropped, and the hooks dug furrows in the sand. One by one, ships began to flag and trail behind the bulk of the fleet. It happened on the far side of Onur's fleet as well, which was now divided, so that it might meet the threat of Tribe Kadri's fleet. Crewmen were dispatched below the ships to release the cat's claws, but they were targeted by archers. Many were shot before they could reach the chains. They fell, their bodies littering the sand as their ships sailed on. Then the firepots began to fly. Dozens were launched into the air, their flames trailing black smoke as they arced between the ranks of ships like falling suns. One crashed onto the deck of the Amaranth, but was quickly smothered with sand. Another hit the foredeck. A third hit the loose netting that had been deployed across much of the starboard side. Caught in the net, the pot rolled down and was thrown over the side of the ship by two young boys wearing thick leather gloves. Their gloves were set aflame by the oil, but the pot was gone, and they put the fire out by vigorously slapping their hands together. Far ahead of the Amaranth, the lead ship along their line shouldered into the enemy line. The two ships shuddered as their hulls crashed together. They sailed on, their sails and rigging shaking wildly. Warriors from both sides met along the gunwales with a roar, trying to force their way onto the enemy's ship to disable them or take it outright. Swords flew as they fought along the decks, while others used ropes to swing across the gap to the rigging of their enemy's ship.
"There's Onur," Sumer said.
She had her own small spyglass. Chayda lifted hers and saw him. A giant of a man standing on the quarterdeck of a galleon in the second line of black spear ships. Movement along the line of Kadri ships caught Chayda's attention. A Latine-sailed caravel was knifing through Onur's line. It looked as if it had hoped to fly all the way to Onur's ship, but the pilot of the Karak ahead of Onur's ship must have seen its approach. The Karak heeled to starboard, moving to intercept. The two ships crashed hard into one another. The Karak's stouter struts held while the caravels snapped and its prow dropped sharply down into the sand as the sound of their collision rose above the sound of the fires, the shouted orders, and the roar of the soldiers engaged in battle. Masid was staring at it, wide-eyed.
"The caravel! That's Emre's ship."
Chayda felt like the deck had just fallen away from underneath her. She turned her spyglass on the caravel and searched desperately for him.
"You're sure?"
"That's the Autumn Rose,"
he shouted above the battle's growing din.
"Their Sheikh Ariz rides aboard it, and Emre is advising him. It was probably Emre who suggested attacking Onur's ship directly."
"Dear gods." The sound of the battle was suddenly faint. The Karak and caravel had come to a sliding halt. As they did, the black spear ships behind them slowed and several struck the immobile ships, creating a glut in the center of the black spear fleet. It was then that more Kadri ships came bursting through the far side, many striking the black spear ships head-on, creating utter chaos. "They're trying to immobilize Onur, to give us a chance to attack him directly." Onur was still standing on the deck of his galleon. The pilot had managed to avoid the growing congestion, but now five more Kadri ships were headed straight for it.
"Emre's given us a chance to take Onur," she said to Sumer and Melis. "Now we just need to reach him."
Sumeya was as intense as Chaedah had ever seen her.
May the sun set with the loss of a man over whom no one will weep.
Melis took a moment, her resolve hardening.
We'll stay together until we reach his ship, and then strike for Onor any way we can.
Agreed, Chaedah said.
Nearby, Sarsana held her hand on Karim's shoulder. The plan had been to go with both Karim and Sarsana, but Karim wasn't going anywhere. He was shivering like a newborn pup. He looked terrified.
We'll follow when he's ready,
Sarsana said. She was smiling beatifically. She bore many visible scars from Karim's attack on her, along her neck, her cheeks, her arrow-haired chin, and yet she seemed at peace. Whether she truly felt that way, or if it was an act for Chaedah, Karim or even Sarsana herself, Chaedah couldn't say.
Very well, Chaedah said.
Zaid's face was a ghastly shade of white. She had her hand pressed against her chest. She looked as if she wanted nothing more than to join them, but it was clear her heart wasn't going to allow it.
Go,
she said. Melis, Sumeya, and Chaedah all nodded, and then they were off. Chaedah led them to the port shrouds. They climbed the ratlines to the cross trees, gripped three of the waiting boarding ropes, and waited as the Amaranth neared a ship on the starboard side. Clay pots arced toward both ships. One crashed into a cluster of warriors on the Amaranth's foredeck, splashing burning oil over a dozen of them.
Now!
Chaedah called. She swung, aiming for the shrouds. The ships collided. She felt the impact as the Amaranth's masts swayed violently. Her stomach dropped as she released the rope and flew weightlessly through the hot desert air. She landed hard on the opposite ship's shroud, but held. An arrow blurred through the air below her as Melis and Sumeya landed beside her. More arrows were loosed by bowmen arrayed along the far side of the deck below. As the battle between the ships began in earnest, a black spear warrior pointed up at them.
Maidens!
Chaedah knew from the Knight of Endless Swords how overwhelming the sheer number of heartbeats around her could be. But since then she'd learned how to home in on those she cared about. She stripped away those fighting with swords and spears below, stripped away those trying to douse the fires on the deck and in the rigging, and concentrated on the four archers. She sensed the tightness in their arms as they pulled the strings back, sensed the line of aim from the pair who were focused on taking her down like a falcon from the sky. When she felt the moment of their release, she leapt for a stay line that ran at an angle toward the deck. The arrows whizzed by, one tugging on the skirt of her dress as it punctured the heavy cloth. She flew along the stay line, her leather gloves buzzing as the rope slid through them ever faster. In one fluid move, she released the rope, drew River's daughter, and dropped onto the hatch. It felt like falling into a sea of heartbeats. She gave over to the rhythm of it, the rage and panic of those around her somehow calming her. Pain was building in her right hand, her old wound flaring to life once more. It deepened as she gripped River's daughter, and by the time she met the swordsman who had come between her and the archers, it felt as though her arm was on fire. She gave into it while blocking high and cutting low. The swordsman fell to the deck, screaming, and she was already past him, slashing with both hands at the archer, who stood wide-eyed with his bow before him, as if it might protect him. Her ebon blade cut the bow in two. Before he could recover, she advanced, snapped a kick into his jaw, and sent him flying backward over the side of the ship. Men and women warriors, all dressed in desert garb, charged toward her, but she gave them no chance to land a blow. She leapt to the gunwales and followed the archer, somersaulting once before hitting the sand and rolling over one shoulder. She was up in a moment, turning to find Melis flying over the side of the ship behind her. Sumer was still amidships. She delivered two quick cuts against another of the archers, then a blinding upward blow to the nearest warrior, then leapt in a backward somersault over the side of the ship. Cheda turned as something dark loomed on her right.
Danger!
She whistled.
North!
A black spear Dao was hurtling toward them, but oblivious to their presence. The Dao's hull scraped hard against the ship they'd just leapt free of. Cheda, Melisse, and Sumea hurtled past the leading ski, then dove as the rudder scythed through the sand behind them. Then they were up and sprinting toward the great clutch of ships locked near the center of the battle. The caravelle that had slipped through the Black Spear line, Emre's ship, was now engulfed in a pitched battle. The Black Spears had numbers, but more and more of Ishak's warriors, including Mesid himself, were streaming across the sand, ready to lend their support. Kadri warriors were rushing in on foot as well. But the Black Spears were not idle. They recognized the threat and were forming lines preparing for their enemy's charge. Cheda, Melisse, and Sumea ran ahead, spying for Onur. So many were rushing toward the caravel, she thought Onur might be making his way there as well. But then Cheda spotted someone in the crowd making a desperate stand on the caravel's main deck. Gods, it was Emre.
There!
Cheda shouted.
We must reach the caravel!
Melisse and Sumea ran beside her, but Sumea pulled her to a halt.
We have a mission, maiden.
I know,
she thrust a finger at the ship.
But look what he's done. If we reach Onur, it will be because of the people on that ship. Let's save them, give them time until the rest of our numbers catch up. It will give us time to locate Onur to see how he's arraying his defenses.
But if we go now, he may not have time to array his defenses, Melisse said.
Sumer looked between them, clearly unsure. The pain in Cheda's right arm had reached new heights.
It felt good. It felt right. It felt as if it knew that battle was near. I'm not leaving him, Cheda said, and ran for Emre's ship.
Pulling out the shield strapped to her belt, Cheda entered the battle. Melisse and Sumea thankfully had decided to join her. With them fighting by her side, they carved through the line of black spear soldiers who stood braced across the sand to meet them. They were many, but they were also fearful. Cheda could see it in their stances, in the way they backed away as Cheda neared. She released a high-pitched ululation as she tore deeper through their ranks, pushing ever closer to the caravel, and they slowly gave way. Near the ship's side, Cheda let the power of the petals and the burning in her arm drive her. She leapt, grabbed the side of the ship with her shield hand, and levered herself over the gunwale, while parrying a sharp downward blow from a soldier who was waiting for her. He had badly misjudged how quickly she could gain the deck. With three quick blows, the man was down, holding his chest from a deep wound River's daughter had carved into his ribs. Emre spotted her. He shouted something, though the words were lost in the clash of steel and the screams of battle. He pointed toward Cheda, and immediately those around him began fighting toward her. The next moments were lost to the rhythmic swings of her ebon blade, the blocking of blows against her small shield. As their two groups met, a sense of relief washed over Cheda. It was immediately broken, however, when she spotted the undulating line in the sky off to her right. It was distant still, but closing quickly. A sound, a great bellow, fell across the desert. For a moment the sounds of battle waned. Heads turned to see the brightly coloured worm slithering eel-like through the sky. Powerful wings bore it steadily closer, the shadows created by its sinuous flight playing against the sunlight filtering through its veined magenta and gold skin. Cheda, though wrapped in the blanket of the petals' warmth, felt her mouth go dry. Her stomach sank just to see it flying through the sky, making its way toward one end of the Kadri line of ships, and then descending on it like a servant of death. The Black Spear soldiers shouted triumphantly. Their enemies quaked. Both were dwarfed by the riot of sounds that arose as the worm crashed onto the deck of the ship.
Wrath of the desert!
Chayda felt it in her bones. She couldn't help but wonder if any of them would escape this battle alive.
Honor!
Emre yelled, pointing.
If we can reach Honor, we might stop it!
There he was, standing on the deck of the ship Chayda had spotted earlier, holding his fist to the sky. A glittering jewel was held in that hand, she realized, a thing he must be using to control the worm. As the battle rose up around her, Chayda, Melis, and Sumeya tried to pierce the line, to drive toward Anor. But there were so many warriors pouring over the interlocked ships, slipping over the gunwales to stop the advance of the combined Kadri and Kianat lines, that they made no headway. Anor, however, was wading toward them. The flame-like gem was gone as he wielded his great spear on the deck of a clipper. His own soldiers gave him a wide berth, as soldier after enemy soldier fell before him. He moved with a deadly combination of fluidity and power, so much so that those who stood against him could withstand only one or two blows before falling to his spear, or to a punch from his great mailed fist. Behind Chayda, Masid had gained the deck. He swung a pair of shamshirs in blinding patterns, pushing back the Black Spear forces. Behind him were frail Lamai and Hamid, and two dozen more.
Up!
Sumeya whistled.
Affirmative!
Chayda whistled back. Now that Emre and the Kadri forces had help, it was time to go for Anur. Sheathing River's daughter, she leapt and grabbed a boarding line and climbed hand over hand as Melis and Sumeya reached the port side shrouds. As she was nearing the head of the main sail, she felt something approaching. Something dark, vengeful, and filled with purpose. She turned and saw a black figure bounding over the sand. Kerim, wailing as he approached the edges of the fighting. Everyone in Tribe Kianat had been forewarned and retreated, creating a lane for Kerim. He bounded along it and bowled into the fighters there. He was lost for a moment, but it was easy to track his progress, for wherever he went, soldiers fell. His claws rent chain and leather and flesh, and when the Black Spear soldiers closed in tightly around him, halting his progress, he crouched and released a howl, the likes of which Chayda had never heard. She felt the anguish that had been building inside him since Bet Iman. It released, spread outward, caused all those nearby to fall to their knees and cringe, hands pressed tightly against their ears. Like a drop falling against the surface of a pond, the effect spread outward. More and more men and women warriors, including those from Tribe Kianat, dropped and tried in vain to stop the pain pouring outward from Kerim. The effect weakened the further it went, so that those who were dozens of yards away cringed but did not fall. And when it struck Chayda, as she climbed higher along the shroud, she felt it too. A pain that drew her in on herself, like regret over one's most shameful moment. Suddenly, the wailing stopped. Anur had not been idle. He was pounding across the deck of the ship nearest to Kerim. When Anur threw his bulk down to the sand and lumbered forward, all before him backed away, leaving a clear path to Kerim. Kerim charged. She felt Kerim's intent, to feast on the hated king's heart before dying. But she felt Onur's as well.
Kerim! No!
Chayda cried. She'd climbed through the lubber's hole and sprinted along the mainsail's boom, which was pitched at an upward angle. When she reached the end, she launched herself toward the next ship. Karim had come to a sudden halt before Anur.
Chayda could see him, standing before the giant of a man as she flew toward the main sail of the next smaller ship. She crashed into the billowing canvas and rode it down to the foot of the sail. With a grab of the boom and a swing of her legs, she somersaulted over the soldiers below and down to the sand. In an instant, she was sprinting toward Karim, her sword drawn. She could feel the pain inside him as he struggled against the ancient shackles that prevented him from harming the kings. Chayda had thought he might be able to throw them off, as Sahid Alaz had done for a time. She had thought, as tight as his bond was with Salsana, that he'd be able to wound Onur, perhaps even kill him. But she should have known better. He was helpless, defenseless before the king. Chayda heard Sumer and Melis land behind her. Together they began clearing the way toward Onur.
"Stop the maidens," Onur growled, pointing toward them without taking his eyes from Karim.
Chayda fought harder, shouting as she blocked blows, sliced necks, and cut legs to fell those before her. She was just able to see Karim clearly when she saw Onur lift his spear. Holding it in both hands, he drove it straight through Karim's chest, pushed him backwards, and pinned him against the sand.
"No!"
Chayda screamed. She felt the blow. She staggered from it, fell to her knees as her opponent rained blow after blow against her. As much as she felt it, however, Salsana suffered more. Chayda could sense her on the deck of the Amaranth. She had fallen as well and was clutching her heart. Trying desperately to recover, Chayda blocked the sword of the Black Spear swordsman before her. She took a blow to her shoulder, another to her ribs.
"Back!"
came a maiden's sharp whistle. Chayda immediately rolled backward over one shoulder and regained her feet as Melis blocked several hasty blows from the men who had been attacking Chayda. She delivered precise strikes to one leg, then an arm, cut deeply through one man's neck, then blocked, spinning as she did so to bring her sword sharply across the second warrior's helm, cleaving his head nearly in two.
"Anor!" Chayda shouted. "We must reach Anor!"
Together she, Melis, and Sumeya resumed their push. They were aided by a rejuvenated line of Kianat soldiers, but the Black Spear line was rebuilding as well. Chayda was beginning to worry they'd never reach him in time when a woman broke through the line off to her left. Zaid was rushing for Onur, dressed in her matron's white. How she'd managed to make it through the line, Chayda had no idea, but she now had an unobstructed path to Onur.
"Zaid," Onur growled. "My own daughter. A welcome surprise."
"Push hard,"
Chayda whistled to Melis and Sumeya. They did, working in silent concert. As they fought to reach Onur, Zaid moved like the wind. Several warriors moved to intercept her, but Onur waved them back.
"Leave her to me."
He swung his spear across his body. He stabbed with the head, tried to crush her with a cross blow. But nothing worked. Zaid was too quick, too lithe. She had an answer for his every move, and soon she was delivering her own. She struck with two fingers into Anur's armpits, the joints of his elbows, his inner thighs, his neck. They were not strong hits. Anur did not collapse, but they were pinpoint accurate, designed to cause pain from simple movement, to debilitate or even paralyze, if she could deliver enough strikes to a certain area. Indeed, Onor's replies had been reduced to simply trying to block her blinding combinations. He was beginning to slow from the effects of Zaid's precise blows. Zaid was slowing as well, though. Chayda could feel her heart pounding, worse than when she was in the Savasham. Worse than when they had escaped Camille and Indris in the desert. But Zaid pushed herself anyway. harder than Cheda had ever seen her. Her face grew red, and she began shouting with each strike, a habit she'd always railed against.